Welcome to Forests, Folklore, and Fantasy. My name is Kelly, but I write and publish under my initials as K.M. Rice. I would like to start off by thanking you, dear listener, for tuning in from wherever you happen to be and letting you know that you are most welcome here. This episode is a very special one because I have a most esteemed guest who I am blessed to consider a friend, and that is Lindsay Crummett. The following that I hope you will enjoy is a conversation between two old friends desperately resisting the urge to catch up and to stay focused on the subject matter, but Lindsay is an absolutely fascinating gem of a human being who has worked in so many different amazing fields. She's incredibly talented, and I think you will find this interview with her absolutely delightful and illuminating. So enjoy. I am so excited to introduce you lovely listeners to the equally lovely, inside and out, Lindsay Crummett. Lindsay is a good friend of mine, and she is an incredibly talented visual artist. And I will let her share with you a little bit more about herself, because she has worked on several projects that I am sure will be familiar to you. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me.
It's my absolute pleasure. Kelly, thank you for having me.
Do you want to give like a quick intro of who you are and what you do? Because I certainly don't want to be speaking for you.
Well, it's quite broad what I do. And I'm trying to like bring it down into a succinct statement. I am a visual artist, exactly like you said. I've been a professional artist in the film and TV and gaming industries for a very long time now, since 2007. And I worked at Weta Workshop for 10 years in the film industry. And we can always circle back around to it. This is not what I do currently, but I was an orc in The Return of the King.
I love that so much.
And so that was my first visit to New Zealand. I'm originally from California, and I traveled to, after visiting New Zealand and getting to be on set for Return of the King in 2003, I finished schooling and returned to New Zealand to try and work as an artist in the film industry, which I was eventually able to break in because I'm obsessive and wouldn't let up. And so then, while I was working at Weta Workshop over those 10 years, I met my husband, and I've now got kids, and I went freelance back in 2018. I still work on a variety of projects, both digitally and traditionally as an artist. I've done digital and traditional sculpting and digital and traditional painting and drawing for all of my projects. So currently, what I'm working on the most is actually a TCG, which stands for Trading Card Game, for those of you that don't know. A big example of that would be Magic the Gathering. But I worked for a game called Sorcery Contested Realms. So I make fantasy illustrations, and they're all oil paintings. So I've kind of come back around to my roots of doing oil painting after doing many, many years of digital art when I was working in the film industry. So that's me in a nutshell.
That's amazing. You have such a breadth of mediums that are within your repertoire of talent. I find that so impressive.
Thank you so much. No, it was, I started off just, you know, as a kid loving drawing. And so I've always, you know, had a connection. Just pencil to paper has always been a love of mine. And I kind of branched out into sculpting when I was in college at university. And so it definitely grew a love for sculpture. But like I started traditionally everywhere and then ended up moving digitally as, you know, the pace quickens in the professional sphere, especially in the film industry. So you have to be fast. And so, you know, technology like Photoshop and ZBrush for sculpting, I utilized heaps for a long time. So I kind of had to learn those things, but like getting to dive back into traditional stuff is kind of like a treat now. So, yeah, it's a good thing.
What are, just to hype you up, what are some of the big films that you have gotten to work on?
Some of the biggest would be The Hobbit trilogy. And I worked as both a sculptor and a concept artist and a collectible sculptor on The Hobbit films. So I was there before it kicked off at Weta Workshop. And funny enough, that was my goal when I moved to New Zealand, was to be working at Weta Workshop by the time The Hobbit kicked off so that I could work on it. Because I was a huge Lord of the Rings nerd, as you can guess from me saying that I flew over here and was an extra as an orc. So I was a big fan. And so that was so I worked on The Hobbit films. Other big films, though, like I worked on District 9, which I love. I love that film. Also the Avatar films. So I was making props on the first Avatar, but I was many years later, I was in the concept art department for all of the Avatar sequels. We've seen the one sequel, Avatar The Way of Water, that's come out, but there's obviously more coming. So that was what I was working on right up until I left Weta in 2018. So I worked a lot on the Avatar films. Many, many other little projects in between. I'm trying to think if there's any other of note, but you know, those are the big hitters that you recognize.
That's so cool. And like, I just love the process of getting to know you and getting to know what you've done, because it's one thing to go see a film and to appreciate a film. It's another to actually start to get a grasp on the many people who are behind the scenes who actually brought the story that you love so much to life. And you're one of those incredibly integral people. And so I would love to chat with you more about that, about what that process is like. But first, Lindsay and I have just been having fun catching up before we even hit record. And we were remembering how we first met.
Yeah. Like,
do you want to tell the story of how we actually met online?
Yeah, I can at least tell from my sides of things.
Yeah.
We were chatting and I literally had forgotten how we first met, because we were talking about how well we get along and how it just feels like we haven't talked for years, but it's like, oh, it feels like we talk every day. And like,
yeah,
I was looking back and going, hey, so wait, where did we? Oh, that's right. I remember I was working.
Just another testament to how strange the internet is, and yet how wonderful it is that it facilitates connections like this.
Exactly. Because I was working at Weta Workshop at the time when I was like, I remembered Kelly and her sister's viral video that went around of them watching the preview for The Hobbit. And it was everywhere. And of course, it started getting sent around at workshop. Everybody was sending it to each other going, oh my gosh, look at these girls. Look how excited they are. And it was like, it was actually more than just that they were excited about the films. I was like, there was this immediate recognition of how excited she was. And I'm like, oh, that was like me and my sister when, like, for all of the Lord of the Rings films, like, we saw the first one and we were just crazy for it. And then we were so over the moon excited, ridiculously over the top excited every time the sequel came out, you know, when Two Towers came out, when Return of the King came out. And so that was how me and my sister acted with each other. And also my sister, I've got a few sisters, but we're the youngest two. My one sister that we used to get really excited about Lord of the Rings also moved to Wellington, New Zealand. So we both live here and work in different aspects of the film industry. And so I sent it to her as well, my sister, and I was like, look, it's us. And I couldn't help myself. I was like, I have to reach out to this girl because they're like, she seems so familiar to me, and like just how she's reacting, it's so cute. And so I messaged you, and I forgot I was even having to ask Kelly. And Kelly, you remember what I said, right?
It was so cute, because it was like back when YouTube had a messaging feature, which I guess I'm like such a bad YouTuber, I didn't even notice when that left. But like, I think you sent us a message at Happy Hobbit, and I remember your profile picture, you had like headphones.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, who is this cool artist woman with her headphones? And then you were like, hey, I actually am in New Zealand right now working on The Hobbit at Weta Workshop. And believe it or not, coming into work each day on a project like this can sometimes start to feel a little ho-hum. And being able to see your guys' video was like so refreshing, because it reminded us that we're not working in a vacuum, that we have people who are eager and excited to see what we've done.
Yeah.
And I was just saying to Lindsay before I hit record, like that viral video, which I guess I should put a link to in the show notes. it became like known as Hobbitception. It took on a life of its own.
Yeah.
Because it was me and my sister freaking out over the trailer, and then Peter Jackson showed it to like the elves in the cast.
Uh-huh.
So, like Orlando Bloom, Evangeline Lilly, and Lee Pace. And they watched us freaking out and they like had a laugh. And mm-hmm. So it was like a reaction within a reaction within a reaction.
And then you guys seeing that video.
That's right, we did.
Yeah, like, that was amazing.
And that was like really early in the morning, so we were like all kinds of hysterical. But some of the comments before, originally Peter Jackson just shared Peter Jackson's the director for The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit films, among other films as well, if you didn't know.
Yeah.
But he, on his Facebook page, had just shared the original reaction to the trailer, and the response was actually quite mixed. It was a bunch of people being like, oh my gosh, I see myself in this, and then a bunch of very derogatory, misogynistic, gross, horrible stuff was being thrown
like
at us.
Pretty much the case for anything that goes viral, you know, you're gonna have gross people saying gross things, as no matter what it is, which is horrible.
I know. Exactly. And like, I wasn't sure how to feel about it at that time, because I was like about to release my first book and I wanted to be seen as a professional. And so then this thing happened unplanned. And when I got your message, I was like, you know what? Forget the haters. Forget any of these trolls who are trying to bring us down. The people who are bringing to life the thing that we love are appreciating what we're doing. And that makes all the difference.
I actually remember now, it's so funny when you start to like really look back, it's a long time ago now, and like you start to completely forget big chunks of time until you talk about it with somebody. And I'm fully remembering, because you know, we worked on it for years before the first film was released, and you know, two different directors, and so you know, we designed the whole film and then scrapped it and started again. So like, it was like so much work had been done already, and like, of course, nobody in the world outside of that building had seen what we were doing, and so it was ho-hum, and it could be frustrating, and the kind of, it's like any other job, for years you're working on something and you're just getting this niggly feedback, and to see that was like, oh, that's right, people are going to be excited.
Yeah.
And it was like this refueling feeling of like driving, okay, no, don't stop putting effort in, you know, don't stop trying to make this the best you can make it. And so it was definitely refueling at the time. So anyway, that was really cute. I completely forgot that was how we met each other.
Yeah.
And then of course, Kelly came to visit eventually and came over to Weta Workshop. And so we got to meet in person.
But yeah. I think even before that, I met you at Comic-Con, because
that's
you and a bunch of other artists who were working on The Hobbit came, gosh, I don't know, I want to say it was like 2013 or something.
2014, because I think it was
2014.
I got married, yep.
Yeah.
Oh. it was a visit. I got married. I went to Comic-Con and I think I got married.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, just while I was there.
So then that was great, because I remember like you're like, oh, I'm the one who messaged you. And I was like, oh my gosh, hi. And then somehow we found out that we'd both grown up with horses.
Yes.
And as you were like signing autographs for people or something, I noticed a tattoo on your wrist. That was a raptor.
Yep. Raptor fossil. And
yes, a raptor fossil. And I was like, is that like what I think it is? And you're like, you're into dinosaurs too? And I was like, oh my gosh, am I? And like, it was just like another moment of like the universe imploding of,
yeah,
yes, you people need to meet. You people need to be friends.
Yes.
That's right.
It was so much in common. It's ridiculous. Your favorite film growing up as a young child, because we're like the very similar age too. And,
yeah.
And we were both about the same age when Jurassic Park came out. We were just discovering with each other. We both went absolutely insane for it.
But yeah. I was just telling Lindsay how I got to go to a retro cinema screening not too long ago of Jurassic Park, because I actually never got to see it in the theater as a child, because I was like, my mom thought I was just too young.
Mm.
And so I finally got to see it on the big screen and like come full circle. And I turned to my younger sister, Alex, and I said, oh, the soundtrack, the theme music, do you remember how often I played that? And she was like, yeah. That was just like the soundtrack of your room. That's just like what your room sounded like all the time. And I was like, it really was that intense, wasn't it? Like, I was there. Like,
mm-hmm.
I was crying over the pelicans flying at the end and mm-hmm. drawing pelicans and then drawing raptors and like skulls and trying to like compare the skulls and
wow. That's awesome. We would have been best friends.
We would have been the best of friends.
It would have been dangerous though, because we would have just like amped each other's fanaticism up. Which we didn't need to amp it up anymore.
I would have been on that plane with you and your sister.
Yeah.
Sneaking down to New Zealand to try to be in the movie.
Yeah, seriously. That's pretty much how it went, because like, yeah, when we first came here, Biz, like, she graduated, she's my sister is like 2.5 years older than me, and she graduated university and in TV and film, and she's, you know, set toward filmmaking, like directing and producing. And so she had a friend from California that she knew who was an animator at Weta Digital, and he was actually like animating Gollum. And like, so she, when she realized that, and he said, you know what, I'm also making some short films on the side, maybe you should come down and you can do some producing for me for these little short films. It'll be some good experience. And, you know, they're filming here, so maybe, you know, you could get in as an extra. And so she was just like gone on a plane as soon as she could go. And it was so hard for me when I was first getting the messages from her and she got accepted to be an extra on set. And she was telling me about it. And as you can imagine, I was still in California losing my mind.
Oh, my gosh.
And so it wasn't long. It was before it was my summertime while I was at university. So it was summer break. And I flew over on my summer break. And flew over and got a job as an extra as well, just for like the 3 months that I stayed. And yeah, so Biz and I were both extras during that time. And it was, we came in right at the end. They were doing pickups on Return of the King. So it was just still getting to have that experience and going on to set was just amazing. And it also kind of solidified that I wanted to work in New Zealand, because the film industry was just so like down to earth and attainable, like as far as it was just so much smaller than Hollywood, and like you could meet people, and it was, you know, the rumors of Peter just running into Peter Jackson at the grocery store were completely true. That happened all the time. I was looking for chocolate one night and was like standing next to Orlando Bloom, who was also choosing which chocolate to get at the time. And so that kind of stuff happened all the time, because it was just such a small, industry. It was a small industry. And so you could just run into people and chat to people. And It was just easier to facilitate. And I kind of just liked that it felt very down to earth. And so I was like, yeah. At that time that I spent on set for Return of the King just solidified that I was going to go finish school and come straight back over and try to get a job there, which of course I did. Yeah. But it was an interesting start.
Well, it sounds like a very adventurous start.
Yeah. I just remember my sister and I definitely amped each other up. And the fact that she came over here and she was just like, yeah. Come. I'm sure we can get you in on set. And I remember getting to wear armor and stuff like that and just being so over the moon about that. It was just like getting to play, pretend on the most amazing sets and wear this incredible armor. And like, okay, little side story. So the day started really early in the morning, obviously, for shoot days. You'd have to get there before the sun came up and get suited up, get your armor on. And then, you know, we're background orcs. So, you know, we're not talking. We're not wearing full prosthetics where we can talk on camera. The background orcs, they looked really good still, but, you know, we had masks that we'd pull on, but you had to paint black around your eyes and black around your mouth so that it wouldn't show under the mask. And so anyway, we'd get there every day and get suited up, and they'd, as soon as you'd get up in a bit of a line, and they'd tell you which trailer to go get your armor from. And they'd give you a letter, either A, B, or C. And that was how cool or how nice your armor was. And it's funny because now I've worked on the other side of this and I did a lot of prop making. And you'll of course get a variety of how good the props look and it's the same for armor. They had to make so much armor. And so some of it looked really amazing and could stand up like right behind the camera, you know? And so that was labeled A armor. And then C armor still looked good, but you didn't want it front and center, if you know what I mean.
is that like the difference between a hero sword?
Yes.
And just a sword?
Yeah, I mean, yes, that's right. But hero even more so is something that like a main character will hold, because that will be like aluminum or aluminium, as they call it here. So that it looks like a proper steel sword. Of course, during certain scenes, depending on who's doing what, they might actually use a steel sword, but usually it's an aluminium sword for like a hero, so that looks absolutely real. Whereas background, we used polyurethane swords. So they were painted and they looked pretty real and they could stand up pretty good. But, you know, again, when you got right up in camera, it wasn't going to stand up too as well. And so they always gave you an A, B, or C. But yes, hero is usually like, hero meant you were like going to be in shot for sure with one of the main characters, if you know what I mean. And so,
yeah, gotcha.
Yeah. And so I remember I always got like B or C, and it was just like, I was not a big tall guy. And so it was just like, I didn't care about whatever I was. And then I remember one day getting given A armor, and I was just, and it was really spiky. It looked very different. I was like over the moon. And like, I was like, I think I remember that day I was right. Like cheering on, and it was a scene where we were a bunch of orcs cheering on the troll that was trying to batter down one of the gates at Minas Tirith. And so so I was like right in shot in that one. And I remember last little bit before you asked me for any further information on this, it's like strolling down memory lane. When I finally got there, and on my first day when I was in armor and my sister was there in armor, and we both had our orc heads on, and it was a really, really cold, like wet morning. And like, so you had air pluming out of your mouth, you know, when you breathed. And so you could see the steam. And so we had our heads on, we had our armor, and we were kind of milling around waiting for them to kind of be ready to call action. And we were looking at each other and like you could see steam pluming out of our mouths. And we're like, you look so cool. you look so cool. It was like, because it just looked so realistic, because even when I say the more background armor still looked really good, they have very high standards about like, yeah. And so no matter what armor you're wearing, it looked pretty freaking awesome. So yeah, no, there was some really fond memories of being on set and just kind of experiencing that, that I think probably solidified that I was going to have to move back here eventually. Yeah.
And when you watch the films, can you spot any moments when you're in the shot?
Yeah, there's a couple shots, that one that I just mentioned, but it's like that one had a really, had really fast camera movements.
Right.
But and so it wasn't super obvious. There's one shot when the orcs are on boats coming into shore at Asgiliath for the siege of Asgiliath, that you can see me. I had like a long pointy helmet on. It's always like I always try and remember what helmet I was wearing for which day, and I can see myself in that shot, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that must be so fun.
And then there's one also where I was behind that lead orc when Aragorn jumps off the ship and the army of the dead arrives behind him, and we had to like, we were behind that lead orc that has like the skulls on top of his head, and we were supposed to see what Aragorn's bringing with him, and then we like freak out and run away. So I can see myself in that shot. And then the other really funny thing was that I all in one day I was an orc most of the day, and then like got to the evening, they're like, are you available for a little bit longer? They're like, can you be a Gondorian civilian? I was like, yes. And I was like super excited about it, but like it was funny, the shot I was in ended up being like knees down where somebody was getting trampled and we're like running over the top of him.
But, oh my like, god.
Yeah, but they totally dressed us all up though. So I was in like a full Gondorian dress, and they had to give me a brunette wig because I was blonde at the time. And so they needed everybody to be brunette, so I had to have a wig. And they even like went so far as to put like a bruise on my face. And it was supposed to be, so I was a Gondorian civilian running away from the orcs on the same day that I was an orc trying to break down the gate to get the Gondorian. Yeah. That was good fun there.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Did you ever, after having that experience, did you ever entertain thoughts about like trying to continue to get work as an extra? Or was it just because it was the Lord of the Rings that you wanted to participate?
It was mainly because it was the Lord of the Rings. I did do a little bit more extra work when I first arrived in New Zealand to move here, because you know I was trying to get a job at Weta Workshop, and I did a few different kinds of jobs, and I actually did a bit of extra work for other stuff, and no major like films. I did like TV shows. I was like in a funny documentary flashback sequence where like on this reality true crime TV show. So I did do some extra work. It was really funny. The all sorts of different kinds, just for a bit of extra cash, and I enjoyed being on the set and kind of seeing how it worked. But yeah, other than that I didn't really want to continue pursuing it as like a career or anything, but it was definitely fun for the time when I had the extra time to do it.
But I imagine too that getting to be in front of the camera, getting to wear the costumes and handle the props, gave you some perspective and lived experience that then you could take with you when you did eventually get hired.
Yeah, completely. It's funny you say that. Like everything gave experience to the next kind of job that I did, which was in a kind of, I only call it ascending because it was ascending to what I actually wanted to be doing. Like I set out to want to do concept art, but when I first got the job at Weta Workshop, I was in props department because that's where they needed people. And so when I say ascending, it's like no job is better than the other. It's more just that I was aiming to be in the concept art department. And so it's funny that when you say that, like being an extra fully gave me better understanding of what happened on set and how things were divvied up between things that were going to be closer to camera, et cetera, and things like that, and how they would be handled, and, you know, making sure things weren't too dangerous for extras to use and things like that absolutely helped when I went to the props department and was making props, because I made like prop guns and swords. I made swords for Narnia, and then like lots of guns for District 9 and Avatar, and so like, but all of it kind of, I had a kind of preconceived idea of what was acceptable to be close to camera, and so I definitely had that knowledge helped me. And then all of my experience in props, and then, and because while I was in props department, I did molding and casting. So, you know, we'd take the original model made item, whatever it was, whether it was like a sci-fi gun or a sword, and then we'd mold it using a silicon mold. And I learned that on the job, which was, but I really enjoyed it, making box molds. And then you cast it in, like I mentioned before, a polyurethane material was usually what we did because it was heavy. So it felt kind of, it made the extras, because it was nice and heavy and sturdy, it made it look real when extras held it. And so we'd use those molds to cast them in urethane. And so all of that helped me when I moved to the sculpting department, and I knew things were going to have to get molded, and I understood how and why and what would be problematic for that process. And then all of that came very useful when I eventually moved to concept design, because I knew that what I was designing was going to have to be sculpted, was going to have to be molded, was going to have to be cast, was going to have to be on set, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's actually quite complicated.
Mm. Yeah, no, it is. And I feel like it was a very accidental route I took that I have a lot of appreciation for, because it gave me a real understanding of how it goes through the entire process. Whereas I even talked to my husband, who I met in the concept art department at Weta, Andrew Baker, and he went straight to concept art because he was from Weta Digital, and that was where all of his training was. And so he went straight into the concept art department. And he even said to me at one stage, well, no, that's actually really cool, because, you know, I need to go to those departments and try and see what's going to be the problem and understand. And so I remember him telling me a couple times that that actually is a really positive thing, like a leg up in a way, to have understanding about what's needed down the line of production, rather than somebody who just, because you could just like paint a pretty picture and go, there you go, make that, and it kind of causes problems for people all down the line.
Of course. You know what, yeah, I mean?
Yeah. Whereas if you have some understanding of how it's going to be made, it can help the process right the way through. So it was accidental. I didn't mean to take that route, but it sort of just rolled out that way. I have a lot of appreciation that I got to experience all those different sides of production.
So it gave you such a well-rounded grasp on everything that goes into the making of a prop, not just the designing of it. But yeah. To backtrack a little, you mentioned that you were always drawing as a kid.
Mm.
At what point do you feel like you started this path of, you know, perhaps deciding like, this is my talent, I recognize this is my talent, or maybe not even that conscious, this is my passion, this is something that I, because personally, I don't feel like I have a choice with writing. I feel like I was born, eventually I could hold a crayon, and yeah, I can do words, and I just have to do that. Like, yeah, that's my thing. Whether anyone reads what I write or not, that's my thing. Did you have a similar experience with art, and how did you continue to carry that through, not only through university, but then through your career?
Yeah, that's really amazing that you had that from such a young age with writing. I do feel like it was pretty similar, that I definitely had an inclination towards drawing from a young age. And I do remember being really excited by the reaction from people when they could really see what I was trying to draw. And when they got excited about it, that made me more excited. And like, it's funny because that can be the case. You know, you have to work on stuff that you love, but also when you see something you've made make somebody else happy or excited, it just buoys you more into wanting to keep going. So I remember that feeling from a really young age, that if somebody was excited about something that I drew, even a classmate when I was a little kid, and they'd be like, can you draw me a horse? And I remember kids like at one point lining up going, okay, can you draw me this? And like, I would just be like, okay, I'll try. But it was an exciting feeling. And so I used that kind of natural tendency to be like, I was driven there to want to be able to try and draw something that I loved. Because if I go right back when I was real little, it was like cats and horses, you know, little girl, I love cats and I love horses. So I tried to draw them as much as possible. and figure that out. And that kind of followed me right into adulthood of trying to, like, when I loved something so much or was really excited about something, a TV show, a movie, I would try and draw it. And so I remember getting to both, like, I think I even mentioned this to you before, but Jurassic Park, when I was very excited about that, I remember we had to write in our journal, like, as a little kid, that, like, what I wanted to do when I grow up. And I was talking about how I saw Jurassic Park and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I want to be a part of, like, bringing something to life like that, that there are no more dinosaurs, but somehow they made it look like dinosaurs were still alive. And I want to be a part of that. And so that was, like, weirdly, like, in the back of my head as a little kid. And then I forgot about it for a long time. I kept drawing. And I remember I told you I was into Jurassic Park, but then got massively into X-Files as, like, when I was in middle school. And I started trying to draw portraits, and I would draw Mulder and Scully all the time. And, like, and I was really hard on myself and be like, that doesn't look like them. And I would just do it over and over and over. And because I loved the show so much, I had that, like, it would just, you know, when you're fanatical about something, you just think about it all the time. So I'd just be drawing the logo, the X from the X-Files on my school books and trying to draw portraits. And so that all helped me get better when I was trying to, you know, master understanding what makes somebody look like somebody in portraiture. That definitely was helping me. And then by the time I got to university, I remember being at this crossroads of what do I actually want to do for a living? And of course, I always loved drawing, but I had it in the back of my head. There was still this old, at that time for me, there was this, the idea of the starving artist, that I wasn't going to be able to make a living off of it.
Oh, right.
And then I remember my auntie, actually, she's awesome. And Lynette said to me, hey, you know, there's lots of ways to do drawing for a living, and you love video games. There's so much drawing and artwork required for video games. Like, that's something you can do. And I remember that was the first seed that was planted in my head, like, oh, right, maybe I could. And so when I got to university, I very much tossed up the idea of going into biology, because I really loved biology in high school. And took AP bio and stuff in high school, loved it. And funny enough, my older sister Lisa, that's her, she's a scientist, and she's, you know, evolutionary biologist, and so she went that way.
And like, that's so cool.
Yeah. And then I loved film and I loved art, so it was like biology, film, and arts, and I couldn't figure out what to do. And then my other sister went into film, and she was, like, just ahead of me, and she did, like, got her degree in TV and film. And I remember, okay, you know what, nobody's done art yet. And it was so funny. It wasn't that flippant, but it was like, you know, I think there are enough places that maybe I could do film and art. Maybe I could do artwork for film. And I came back to that old, like, journal entry as a little kid being like, actually, you know, maybe I could help do the artwork that helps the pre-production artwork for film and games. And so there was no courses for that at my university that I was going to, but I sort of tailored them for myself. And like, and while I was at university, Lord of the Rings came out, and I remember we were supposed to do, like, a face sculpt with, like, the musculature underneath on one side, and I was like, can I do an orc? And they were like, sure, I guess. And so things like, I would, like, try and start making things for my portfolio that I thought would be helpful, and so I sculpted, like, an orc face and did the musculature underneath, and then I did a lot of creature design. I was really into creature design. That's where the biology comes in. So it's like, you know, I kind of utilized all of my passions, because I really love creature design. I studied a lot of animal anatomy and all the art courses that I took, and so it was just a real meshing. And so I had a lot of loves, and unlike you, that I didn't know it was going to be drawing when I was a kid. I loved it, but I had all these, it was finding the path that was going to utilize all those passions that I had. And once I did find it, I was like, oh, okay, this is it. And like, as I've been going on that journey, it's been definitely that just somehow I wanted to help visualize, to tell these stories. And I've actually delved into, I haven't even talked to you about this, but I've delved into writing as well. And
ooh,
really loving it, because I'm just finding more and more that my love of film, you know, really drives me to want to be a part of the actual story. I kept on finding myself that way inclined when I was working with people at Weta Workshop. And if we had a chance to like collaborate on a story aspect of a project, then I was so engaged and I wanted to help visually, but I also loved the story and character development. And so like, for example, a place we got to do that was on the Avatar sequels. Of course, I can't talk heaps about it, but all I could say is that we were able to like really world build from the ground up. So we would get into these meetings and have these really broad stroke conversations about cultures and how they interacted with each other and literal world building. And that part just made my brain go super. I loved it. And of course, I start to picture visually. But so that, yeah, it's not been so clear that it's just drawing for me, but it's just the whole creative sphere that is storytelling, both visually and everything else. So it's like I didn't have such a clear path, and like right now what I do is very, very illustrative, which is cool because it's not concept art. Concept art is very much throwing out an idea of, okay, you have this creature, this is the description of what it, or the part it plays in the story, can you visualize it? And then go, okay, no, that's not quite, there's somebody, your client says, no, that's not quite right that for these reasons, and it needs to function this way. Okay. And then you do get, keep doing it again and again until you get what the client wants. Whereas right now I do illustration, which is very much storytelling. It's how do you tell a story in one image and try and pack as much story into a single image so that somebody can come along and have no context and go, ooh, that's so cool. She looks like this type of character, but she looks a little bit dangerous, but she's also vulnerable. And oh my gosh, what else is in this image that I can kind of put together what's going on and who she is? And so that's the kind of illustration I do right now, is trying to like tell a story in one picture. But yeah, all the writing stuff, my endeavors are IP building on the side.
Ooh.
Yeah. We'll have to talk about that sometime.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk about that.
Yeah.
So your creativity takes so many different shapes, and it sounds like it's still continuously evolving and changing and adapting, which I absolutely love and can completely relate to. But obviously, you are a Tolkien fan.
Mm.
What would you say, as we wrap up here, draws you to fantasy as a genre, if that's a fair statement?
Mm. Wow. It is a fair statement, and it's so broad. It's like it makes me go, oh wow, I have to question my existence here. It's a great question, because I have to like again try and go back to childhood almost and go, you know, what was it when I was a, you know, tiny little girl? I remember one of my favorite movies at the time for so long was Legend. You know, from 1984, I believe, Tom Cruise and Darkness and Tim Curry, that one. So it was such high fantasy, that one. It was like the quintessential, and it's actually visually stunning even still when you go look, watch it again. And something about being so transported from our world, and it's not, it's interesting. I've had a lot of discussions with everybody, from my husband to other artists. It's not really escapism. It's like another way to experience our own world, because there's always, you know, if you just have a fantasy setting, it's boring. You have to have characters that you love and follow, right? We, you know, in all of Tolkien's writings, there was always these beloved characters that you're following, multiple. And so it's like, all these characters have real aspects of human beings, of people we know. You know, we know a Sam, we know a Frodo, we know. And so it's like we know the feeling of being tasked with something that feels bigger than us. We know the feeling of having to dig deep to find strength in us to do something greater than ourselves. You know, these are all things that we experience as human beings. And I think it's like just, from the time I was young, is like there, you get drawn in by things like, you know, unicorns in that movie, where just, oh my little mind was blown. So unicorns, and there was these goblins, and like this big representation of darkness with, he was like the most quintessential, you know, devil that you'd seen. I don't know why, but I've always had a love for villains just as much as protagonists. And I remember when I was very young, I memorized Darkness's speech at the opening of Legends. He says, like, Mother Night, fold your dark wings about me, protect me with your black embrace. It's like, that's a whole long thing, right? And I was this tiny little girl, like probably five or six years old, and I was like doing
this angelic looking little blonde girl.
Uh-huh. And I was doing it in the deepest voice I could muster, you know. I remember like saying, going to my grandmother that came to visit one day, like, hey, grandma, listen, I memorized this, and just starting to spout it off. And she looked so concerned. And like, she also happened to be highly religious, and like, it didn't go down well, but it was like, there was something in me that was just like, all these characters that are basically extreme aspects of the human condition, you know, that you see illustrated in front of you. Everybody has a dark side, everybody has a light side, and like, you know, that's represented in that film. They say, what is light without dark, you know? And each person in themselves has dark and light. And so I think I fell in love with symbolism in fantasy as well, like that it was so much more than just escapism. It wasn't just escaping to a different place, because there's so much recognizable. It's not another planet with beings we don't recognize. It's you know, slight differences in things bringing to life these magical ideas that I think humans have had, you know, these curiosities about nature and things they don't understand, and we try and fill in the gaps of what we don't understand, and so there's still things about our natural world that we don't know yet, and things about what are in the depths of the ocean that we don't know. And so I think there's also always been a huge fascination with me about the question marks, the things that we don't have answered as human beings yet. You know, like, is it, what is possible? What is the extent of what exists out there that in our own world that would blow our minds? And I think you can explore those things in fantasy. And, you know, sometimes they're actually not as far outside of the realm of reality as we'd think, if you know what I mean. And so, and like I said, the symbolism of what things represent in fantasy, I think I find that such a beautiful way to illustrate points and tell the story of people and the different sides to us. And so there's so much going on, layers within fantasy, where it's not just a straightforward story of this guy that lives down the road, and or he's, you know, he's trying to rob a bank. And it's like, it's just, it is what it is. Like, and so for me, fantasy means layers and peeling back those layers to see what the symbolism means, and try and therefore kind of taking it to heart even more. And so, yeah, I think I love the visual aspects, that there's these beautiful things that we want to, you know, wish existed, like unicorns and crazy devils, and like that is very visually stimulating, but also on a story level it's very stimulating, because it does have, it represents something to us in our real world. Sorry, that was quite a rant.
No, I loved it. I couldn't agree more, because I hold the belief that fantasy as a genre, especially high fantasy, is our modern form of myth making and myth telling.
Yes.
For the very reasons that you just so eloquently pontificated, because it is told through symbols. It's told through archetypes. It happens in a world not of our world, in a time not of our time. And having just that little bit of removal somehow gives our psyches permission and safety to explore otherwise challenging concepts. Things like, you as a very young child were drawn to the darkness because children are completely aware that there's darkness. They're completely aware that there's death. They're completely aware that there's these things that maybe our society doesn't know how to talk to them about. even as adults, we don't know how to talk about all of these things, but it's being acknowledged and mirrored.
Yeah.
Through the visual medium or through the storytelling. And it's very validating and comforting to explore these concepts through fantasy with again, just that like thin film of removal from our world. It's like it gives our imaginations permission to like leave everything we know at the door.
That's a very good way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah. Go into this other realm where you don't have to have your identity with you or the baggage of your culture with you.
Yep.
You can explore.
And you can check it at the door. And then of course you see things all of a sudden and you'll be experiencing something in a story and then all of a sudden it clicks and you recognize it as, oh my goodness, you know, that's almost a representation of racism right there. You know what I mean? Like, and we're with these different like beings and cultures that are not of our world. And so it's like, it puts it, because you've removed it from your own biases, you can see
it. And defenses.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's something beautiful there. And I think some people, it can almost be looked down on, like fantasy, like, oh, that's childish. That's funny. You like fantasy. And it's like, I think maybe
those are the people who don't get it.
Yeah. I think maybe you don't quite understand.
Yeah.
And that's okay. You're into something else. But, you know, I do think that, my love for fantasy has never gone away. I do love sci-fi as well. And like, and there's times where I really like adore a Western. I'm feeling in a cowboy Western mood. And I always have, but like, I always come back to fantasy. And like, so it's like, it's definitely got a home and as far as things that I love and always come back to. And definitely when I do writing, I kind of, my brain wants to go there. Cause like you said, it gives you full permission to construct something that's similar to our world, but you don't have to know every aspect of it when you're writing. You can make some of it up and you can base it off of other things and then run with it in a different direction. What if it was like this? And it gives your mind this total freedom to go, what if, what if, what if, what if? And I think that's actually really good for the mind to be in that kind of state of what if, because it's open is what it is. It's an open state of mind rather than a closed state of mind. Closed is just like, no, this is how it is and that nothing exists outside of that. It's closed. And so it's almost like fantasy and when you exercise putting yourself in fantasy or thinking and imagining and writing fantasy, it puts you in an open state of mind. And so I can't help but think it's a positive thing when you embrace it.
I totally agree. And I'm going to have you on again sometime soon as a guest, because we didn't even get to chat about folklore yet. And I know you've been doing some beautiful art and experimentation in the realm of folklore, dealing with folk creatures and mythical creatures. And
yes. Yeah.
So
it's just too easy to talk to you. That's all. There's just too much to say. we can do a part two and maybe get my sister on here, the other orc.
Yes, I would love to interview her as well.
Yeah, and she, however, you can see her face in the films, and that always made me mad because she got to be like a Gondorian princess in the coronation scene at the very end when Aragorn's getting having his coronation. I know you know that, Kelly, but like she's like standing right in between Aragorn and Arwen before they kiss, and I'm like, every time I see it now, I'm like, oh, there's Viv.
She wore a shirt to Comic-Con with the still and her face circled. So it was amazing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Lest there be any confusion.
Yes,
here I am.
Yes, do not be confused. Here's a red circle. Yeah, so we could definitely do that.
And in closing, where can people go to find your artwork and to support you and to keep up with you and to see what marvelous things you're doing next?
Yeah, it's always thank you so much. It's always a big question, and I've sort of changed. Platforms can be so unreliable these days, but I think the longest standing one that I still upkeep the most as far as releasing my artwork is Instagram. So my handle is @Lindsay_ lindsey.crumbs_art. So that's lindsey_crumbs_art. So yeah, Lindsey Crumbs Art.
I'll also put the link in the
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
So that's my Instagram I do keep up the most. I hit a wee snag with freelancing and Patreon, but I actually am planning to go back there probably within the year. So when I do that, that'll be a great place to send people, but I'm not there yet. So at the moment, all the work I'm releasing, illustrative and otherwise, is on Instagram. I'm on Facebook. I was doing TikTok for a little while, but and I've got an art station that has definitely a catalog of stuff that I've done in the past that you can go to. Lindsey Crummett, my full name, on art station. But yes,
and also
yes,
you can check out her artwork on the cover of two novels.
Oh yes,
okay, well probably more than just two novels, but yeah, two of my novels.
Yeah,
she did the cover art for the second edition of Darkling and for The Watcher.
That's right, that is
no, we
correct.
didn't even talk about that. Yet
too much to talk about.
I know.
Awesome.
Well, I know you have to run, but thank you so very much for gifting all of us some of your time and sharing with us a bit of your origin stories and your adventures and your thoughts on being a happily employed creative. It's been really positive for me to hear about it, and I'm sure that everyone listening has had a great takeaway as well.
Oh, I so appreciate it, Kelly. Anytime. I'd love to do it again. It's been a good means for me to reflect and combat the old imposter syndrome that I've done a bit in my life, so I think everybody needs to stop and reflect every now and again, and you'll realize actually you've come quite a ways.
Yeah, put your life into context and remind yourself that you don't always need those big shiny external markers of validation. Sometimes it's even coming full circle, as you did, looking at how well-rounded your education was and in all the different aspects of prop making and the visual arts and things of that nature, to see how much you actually know that other people didn't have the ability or opportunity to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and just having, if you have the mindset of trying to create value or make use of every experience, it never goes to waste, and you'll find yourself evolving, as you put it, or like along a road is toward, you know, what you truly want to be doing. So I'm still on that road. I'm still going. And I'm still evolving, but I'm enjoying it. And I do find that the more you understand yourself and what you truly want to be doing, the higher your standards are, and the more you choose very carefully who you want to work with and find people that resound well with wanting to create the type of work you create. And so you make better and better work because of that as time goes on. So yeah,
you find your tribe.
That's right, exactly, 100%. And you're totally in my tribe. Thanks, Kelly.
Oh my gosh, I'm honored. You're in my tribe too.
Yes So honored.
Well, I will let you go, but thank you once again so very much for joining us.
That was my absolute pleasure. Thank you, Kelly.
You're welcome.
Okay, chat again.
Thank you so very much once again to Lindsey Crummett for joining me for that delightful discussion, and also to you, dear listener, for lending us your ear for the better part of an hour. Again, I will put all of the links we mentioned in the show notes if you feel moved to go check out Lindsey's Instagram. I definitely encourage you to do so. You won't be disappointed. I would also like to thank my supporters over on Patreon, and I likewise encourage you to join our community over there. You can join for free and choose to upgrade to a membership tier if you are so moved to do so. I would also like to thank the brilliant composer Lane Thomas for the use of some of his music in this episode and in all episodes so far in this podcast. It is a track titled The Village from his fantasy-themed album, The Lands Beyond. If you are enjoying this podcast, please do give it a follow. Feel free to leave a rating and a review. And of course, what helps the most
is if you recommend it or share it with a friend. Thank you so very much for all of your support thus far. And until next time, may your hearth be warm and your heart be full.